again, everyone, to TOSP, the official Cyblogs podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Elf.
I'm Amy.
And today we have a nice, short, snappy collection of interesting science from across the net. We've got all sorts of interesting things today. Amy, do you want to take us through what you're going to be talking about?
Yeah, I'm going to cover some LEDs which have an efficiency of over 100%, in fact, far over 100%, and explain how that is possible and what's going on. We're also going to look at the first ever image of atoms moving inside molecules, and going to talk about the QWERTY effect as well. We'll find out more about that. And then also just a little bit about 8 hours in sleep.
Oh, cool. Mm. And I'm all about molecules and atoms this week. So talking about antimatter spectroscopy, symmetry breaking and the hunt for the Higgs boson, solar storms, and MRI detecting whether people are telling the truth or lying or not, which is all very interesting.
Indeed.
So I guess to leap straight into it, antimatter spectroscopy. So for starters, I'll do my best to actually explain what on earth that is. if you haven't heard of it, don't worry. It's a brand new field of science that's only emerged this week because there hasn't actually been that much antimatter around before that. So any great fans of Dan Brown will be aware that we have for a number of years now been able to collect or produce the stuff called antimatter, which is the exact opposite of matter, in such a way that if you brought it into contact with matter, it would annihilate. And by annihilate, I mean immediately turn all of the mass contained within the matter and the antimatter into energy, which would be expressed as light and explosions and
a
just general
boom.
Badness, which forms the basis of a plot for terrorism in Dan Brown's book, Angels and Demons.
Oh, God.
I should note, at this point, it's a great book, and the science in it is actually correct with one big flaw. So the Angels and Demons book is based on the premise that getting enough antimatter together would turn it into a large scale equivalent of a nuclear bomb, which is entirely correct. The one problem with the book is that with current methods to generate antimatter, that would take, I think it was, I read a calculation, something in the region of about 15 billion years, which is 1.3 billion years older than the universe itself. So there's no great worry there. But we have managed to produce antimatter, but we can only produce it in very, very small amounts because of how we actually do it. It's by firing, I think it's neutrinos into big, dense lumps of matter, and occasionally these anti-electrons come flying off, and anti-protons as well. Anyway, long story short, after developing these ways to produce antimatter, we've got reasonably good at it. We can capture it. We can hold it around for up to minutes at a time now, which is pretty cool. But what's happened this week, and it's published in Nature, is that we've actually begun to investigate the properties of these anti-atoms, if you like. And we just haven't been able to before because, A, there haven't been enough of them, and, B, we haven't been able to hold them around long enough for us to actually investigate them. So what this group has done is they've bombarded a molecule of anti-hydrogen. So just to give a bit of background, anti-hydrogen is incredibly complicated to make because you essentially have to produce all the antimatter components of hydrogen separately, and then you have to put them together without them touching any normal matter, because otherwise they will explode. So this is like working with the most delicate chemistry equipment in the world. You have to do it all with lasers. So they did manage to trap a few atoms worth of antihydrogen, and now what they're doing is they've begun to bombard it with microwaves. And by bombarding it with microwaves, you can look and see what wavelength microwaves are actually absorbed by these molecules, and that wavelength tells you a lot about the electrical structure of these molecules. Now, to go back a wee bit further again, there is a whole theory surrounding the properties of antimatter. In fact, a lot of our understanding of symmetry and our understanding of the universe hinges on the fact that antimatter is identical to normal matter. It's just the exact opposite in every possible way. If it's not the exact opposite, that means we don't understand how the universe works. And the good news from the Nature paper this week, or the good news if you like science, is that the measurements stack up. So antihydrogen appears to be electrically identical to normal hydrogen. I should also say, as a slight corollary at this point, that the measurements they've made at the moment aren't particularly precise, but they're the first measurements that have been made. So it's all going to be better from here, I guess. But that's really exciting, and it should get more interesting in the future when we can start to put things like anti-helium together, and then who knows from there.
Yeah.
But it will take some time.
Gosh. Cool. Well, thanks for that. I've got nothing much to add other than just, you know, grinning madly in the background. Right, so I'm going to...
I should say, sorry, before we go on, one of my favourite podcasts is called Futures in Biotech, and it's produced by the Twit Network, and they've just produced an amazing full-length hour-and-a-half episode on how they actually produce and trap antimatter. It's well worth listening to. It's an amazing episode, and we'll link to it in the show notes if I remember to put it in.
Fantastic.
So if you're interested, listen to that.
Right, thanks, Alf. Yeah, so the first piece that I'm going to be talking about this week is all about LEDs, light-emitting diodes, these wonderful little lights that we've been using for years in the infrared spectrum for things like remotes or remote controls, but now we're increasingly using them for light in the visible ranges, so VLEDs. In fact, you can now see them, they get sold as geeky strips with microcontrollers, or you can make cubes with them, or the sort of maker community is going... there was a word that's probably not right for radio on that one. Nuts for them. Thank you. yes, so this piece of research talks about, for the first time, researchers have demonstrated that an LED can emit more optical power than the electrical power that it consumes. So this means that it's got over 100% efficiency. Now, before everybody gets very, very excited, and I'll explain more about this shortly, it needs to be pointed out that the effect only works for very, very, very low input powers and extremely low levels of emitted light. So we're not commercially, let's say, right there yet, but I'll also cover some of the potential uses for this. So what happens is, and the research is published in Physical Review Letters, as always, we'll link to a post explaining it. And the key, apparently, to achieving this was to greatly decrease the applied voltage. Now, light emitted actually scales linearly with voltage. So what they found was that as they halved voltage and thus halved the amount of light that was emitted, the sort of quantity of photons emitted by the LEDs, the input power necessary to do this was in fact decreased by a factor of 4. So in other words, the LED's efficiency increased as its output power decreased, and they finally got up to an efficiency of 230%. But this was at 30 picowatts of input power. Now, a picowatt, for those who didn't immediately do that piece of maths, is a trillionth of a watt, so 10 to the minus 12. So it's a vanishingly small amount. And it's put out 69 picowatts of light. So again, you've got that 30 picowatts input power, 69 picowatts light. That's really cool. That's your 230% efficiency. And the physical mechanisms work just the same as they do with any LED. So what happens is you take a diode, and you have a semiconductor material in it, and what kind of semiconductor you have just sort of determines the color of the LED. James, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Right, sorry about that. Determines sort of what kind of color and et cetera you'll get. So what happens is when excited by the applied voltage, electrons, free electrons, basically cross this diode, and as they do so, they can pop into any existing electron holes. If they're dropping down an orbital layer, they have to, of course, shed some energy. Think of a car needing to get into a parking spot, and of course, it's got to shed some energy to do that. Now, the electrons, for them doing that, basically, how they shed this power, this energy, is in the form of photons, which make light. So basically, that's what happens. Now, what's particularly interesting here is that, this all happens, there's a probability of this happening to the electrons, and previous researchers have tried to look at increasing the probability of this happening as a way to make it more efficient. These guys didn't. These, in fact, took advantage of very small amounts of excess heat that were emitted during the process. And, the heat arises from vibrations in the device's atomic lattice. And apparently this is due to entropy. So we're talking tiny effects here. But they used that heat to sort of up what was put out instead of just using more power. And of course, this is really interesting because it cools the LED slightly. So it's kind of like a thermoelectric cooler. It's again, not practical at room temperature or anything like that, but there are applications in designing lights that don't generate heat at all. And anybody touching LEDs will already understand that they don't get hot like incandescent bulbs do. It could also be used as a heat pump. So it might be useful for solid state cooling or power generation. So really, really, really interesting. And there are all kinds of scientific applications and blah, 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 blah. But that's the piece of research. If nothing else, hooray for efficiencies.
Cool. So just to make sure I'm understanding this correctly, because usually efficiencies are... So your kind of fraction of energy that you put in divided by the amount that you get out.
Yeah.
So it's usually less than 100% because, all the laws of physics tend to break down when you start getting more energy out than you actually put in. But rather than violating this, this is getting energy from a different source and turning it into light, yeah?
Exactly. So what happens is you've got the input energy, but then also tiny amounts of heat that acts as extra input energy as well. So,
cool.
Yes, if you look at the electrical power to light emitted, yes, that's a greater than 100% efficiency, but not once you add in the heat effects. So still very, very, very clever, and there may be interesting ways to scale it up over time.
Oh, fingers crossed. We can research into things like phonons, which are the lattice vibrations you were talking about. It's going on all the time. And they have some extremely cool stuff that I probably shouldn't talk about going on at the moment. Anyway, unless you've got anything else on there, Amy.
Nope.
Right. So once again, talking about particles, I've come back to everyone's favorite at the moment, Higgs boson, in all of its glory. So people will probably be aware that in December last year, the LHC, just before they shut down before Christmas and had months and months off, slackers, they announced that they thought a bump in their data, and that bump was indicating a region where the Higgs boson could conceivably be hiding. Now, there's not enough statistical evidence for them to say that it definitely was there, but for those of you that keep track of the energies, that was positioning the Higgs somewhere between 124 and 126 giga electron volts. And just as they got those data, they had to shut it down for the Christmas period where they do repairs and, kind of make sure the whole thing's not going to explode again.
Yeah.
So what they've done in the meantime is they have been data processing. They've been going back through their old data, and they've also been comparing it with data from other large colliders from around the world. And probably the second most famous one, it's certainly in the news a lot at the moment, is the Tevatron at Fermilab. Now, this is a much smaller collider. And it's actually, unfortunately, just been shut down. They did their last experiments in September of 2011. But they're still going through and analyzing a bunch of their data. And what they have found is a bump in the same region that the Large Hadron Collider results have found. So their bump is between 115 and 135 giga electron volts.
Wow.
So their range of error, if you like, is much, much larger. But it is in the same region as their LHC result.
Mm.
Unfortunately, they can't reproduce the experiments because they've shut the whole Tevatron down now, and they're actually starting to rip it apart and steal chunks of it for other experiments. Because been completely and utterly decommissioned, but it's just really interesting to note that two experiments, two different pieces of experimental apparatus at two different points in the world, have both come up with something that could represent the Higgs boson. Again, even with both of these results, adding them together, it's not statistically significant enough for anyone to definitively state that there's a discovery. There's a needed level of accuracy for that,
yeah.
But it's encouraging.
Absolutely. If you go back and look into all the blog posts and sort of articles written last year, that 124 to 126, and of course, 115 to 135, the middle of that is 125, which is the middle of 124 and 126 as well. So interesting. Sorry, I just knocked my microphone. But there were actually, while it's not, they can't say we have found the Higgs boson, there is certainly something very, very interesting happening with that bump. So I'd encourage our listeners to go back. If I remember, or if we remember rather, we'll link to some of the more explanatory sort of writings that came out last year about why this bump is not just, you know, a bump, but possibly, you know, the bump, as it were.
It sounds like we're talking about some kind of pseudo pregnancy and the kind of.
I was just thinking that, yeah.
Yeah, subatomic regime. But it's really, really encouraging. So all I can say is to those people at the LHC, get on your bike and start doing some more experiments, please.
Yeah. Find more money. I think that's a big problem for them. Anyway. All right.
Moving swiftly along.
Is it me again?
It is indeed.
Fantastic. I'm also talking about. I'm talking about atoms, which is a couple of steps up from things like the Higgs. And this is quite cool. So this is the first ever images. And in this case, it's sort of like a frame by frame film. So I wouldn't go with like really high frame rates here, but it's a film-ish. Pictures of atoms moving inside a molecule, which is quite cool. We haven't actually been able to do that sort of in real life, as though, you know, we had a flashbulb and we were looking at what's going on. And of course, atoms do move in molecules. For anyone who wasn't sure about that, it's not sort of some static thing at all. So what's happened is these are researchers from Ohio State University, and it's a completely novel technique and quite an interesting one. Basically, they used an ultrafast laser, so it was firing at 50 femtoseconds. Now, a femtosecond is a quadrillionth of a second, so it's very, very fast. they fired at molecules, and I'll talk about the molecules shortly, that they used using this ultrafast laser, and basically were able to knock a single electron or electrons off the outside of the molecule. And then what happens is this molecule kind of comes crashing back in, and the scattered signal of this electron as it sort of crashes back into the molecule is measurable. They can pick it up, they can measure it, and it's kind of exactly like a flashbulb or you know, a flash when you take an image. And so they were able to reconstruct the inner workings of the molecules they used, including things like where the atom nuclei were. And also, because there's and this is where the film bit came in, but because there's a very short lag between when the electron was knocked out and when it came, you know, crashing back, the researchers were able to capture the movements of the atoms within that period. So this is where that's where you get the movie. The molecules they used were very simple. They used oxygen and nitrogen, so that's O2 and N2. The reason for that, of course, is their molecular structures are extremely well understood, and they're very simple molecules. The next steps they're going to try and image far more complicated molecules. And the idea is that this is also very interesting because it might allow them to really control chemical reactions down to the atomic level.
And
we'll post up a picture of it.
Cool.
I know, right? The images are phenomenal. So again, we'll post links to the images and a more full description for anybody who's interested sort of in the exact physics of this. But great stuff and a fantastic idea.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. Well, I guess moving along again, for anyone that doesn't know, the world is actually going to end this year, so we'll be finishing up TOSP pretty soon. And it's going to be because the Mayans are correct and the sun is going to explode and kill us all. I was being slightly sarcastic there. Seriously, though, last week there is one of the largest solar storms in recent years that has been buffeting the Earth, and you know, the usual naysayers and doomsayers coming out in force before the actual event hit. So it reached its peak on Thursday last week, and it had the potential to do some quite serious damage. As far as I'm aware, it hasn't actually done a great deal, mostly because we were aware that it was coming. But solar storms do have the potential to cause widespread damage. So what happens with these things is you get big storms, just like we get storms here on the Earth, but they're on the surface of the Sun, and because they're on the Sun, they're slightly bigger, on the order of the magnitude of, you know, a larger size than our planet. And they cause huge eruptions. They're called coronal coronal mass ejections, and essentially big chunks of the sun come flying out whenever you get one of the storms on its surface. And every so often, it will come flying out and head straight for the Earth. conveniently, now
I was going to say, it should be pointed out at this point that it's not chunks the way chunks of the Earth might come out, like actual stuff.
No, it's not chunks of rock, but it is chunks of, well, there's actually three different phases, which is quite interesting as well. So the first two phases kind of affected Earth mid last week, and they're really intense bursts of electromagnetic radiation right the way across the spectra. They hit the magnetic fields of the Earth, and these are some of the things that lead to aurora and a bunch of other effects. They're really, really highly charged particles, and just to give you some idea of how devastating these would be, if we didn't have a large magnetic field on the Earth to kind of protect us and bend these horrible things away, we'd all get cancer and die really, really quickly. Actually, we'd probably just be barbecued to a crisp almost instantly. It's one of the things astronauts have to contend with when they're in space, because once they're out of not only the protection of the atmosphere, but the magnetic field decreases as you get further away from the Earth as well. They have to be exceedingly careful where they are when these solar storms hit. And so a lot of the US departments that run satellites, and all the satellite departments across the globe, had to carefully shuttle their satellites into position so they wouldn't get all their electronics fried, amongst other bits and pieces. The final chunk of these flares, so there's two waves of electromagnetic radiation, and the final is a plasma cloud. So this is a chunk of actual particles, and because the particles have mass, they can't move as quickly as the electromagnetic radiation. So these typically wash over the Earth a few days later, and they were hitting us over the weekend. And these are the ones that can cause a really, really large
problem.
Systems failure, like, yeah. So the other ones can knock down satellites, but these can disrupt power grids. They can disrupt the GPS systems. They can essentially screw up your stuff, to use the technical scientific scientific thing. And the interesting thing is not that this is going to cause the end of the world. Obviously, we're still here, even though this was kind of reaching its peak towards the end of last week. But the sun, the suns and these coronal mass ejections go on roughly, and this is very roughly, at about 11-year cycle. So it'll get really active in the 11th kind of year, over about a two-year period, and then it'll calm down. And the sun's actually been in a calm region for quite a long time. I think it's about 15 or 16 years. Yeah. So we're almost getting a wee bit worried before a couple of years ago, but now we're progressing into this active phase. So we'll be seeing more of these in the near future. Don't worry about it. We are prepared. We have got good things monitoring the sun. We know when these things are coming, and we can take pretty accurate precautions. Just try not to find yourself in space when these things hit, and you know, we should survive, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, we should. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Alf, but was that an X5?
I'm not sure, actually.
I think so. Anyway, never mind then. Of course, we can point out to our listeners that these sorts of events are ranked on a scale from sort of, we've totally noticed it, and it might be a little bit uncool, to, oh dear God, we're all going to die, we're all going to die, we're all going to die. So, always watch when you hear stories about this. Always have a look to see what the rating is.
And there is also, you know, spaceweather.com, which will just let you know the latest in space weather updates, and how exactly we're all going to die.
it is quite cool, though. I mean, there are a lot of worries about sort of what happens with the biggish one to electricity networks and communications networks and things. But what's been happening, Canada, for example, has been clobbered the last decade or so by this stuff. They keep losing, like, major infrastructure. But countries are aware of it, so they're starting to look into what can be done, things like building redundancy into electrical networks so that if a section is knocked out, much like the internet, you know, everything can route around the damage as opposed to just whole areas going dead. And also ways to, for example, be able to, if we know one of these is coming, to be able to power down, for example, the satellite grids while it's happening and then power them back up. And in that way also diminish a lot of the really bad damage that can happen. So, yeah, people are thinking about it.
Yeah. And I should say, even though we're going into a more active region, regime of the sun, when I say this to a lot of people, particularly up at the observatory, people start freaking out and thinking that it is the end of the world. Remember, the sun goes through an 11-year cycle. Now, the Earth has been around for more than 11 years. For those of you, well, I'm sure some people don't believe that, but some people are idiots. so, you know, there's no reason to really worry. Life has been around for several billion years and has survived many such events in the past. So it's probably not worth losing too much sleep over.
Twitter hasn't, though, which is why we need to be careful.
Oh.
Right.
How will society survive?
Moving along swiftly. So this one does actually involve communications technology. So nice segue there. Well done, me. I wasn't actually thinking about that. Anybody listening to Critical Mass today on the radio, I caught it briefly on the way back to work from a dental appointment, actually talked about it as well.
Amy, sorry. I think your microphone's just slipped down. We're getting a lot of puh and tuh, and you're very quiet all of a sudden.
Oh, that's strange. Can you hear me better now? I've not touched anything.
Good.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, heard about it on the radio today, which is kind of funny. But it's called the QWERTY effect. So some researchers publishing in Psychonomic Bulletin and Review, which is a fantastic name for a journal, have looked at how the QWERTY keyboard specifically, now the QWERTY keyboard is the keyboard that most of us, certainly in the Western world, use, may actually be influencing how we feel about words and whether we attach more positive connotations to words as a result of using the QWERTY keyboard. Now, a little bit of history first on the QWERTY keyboard. I'm going to get that tongue-tied a lot. There are two others. There's the Dvorak keyboard, which is the second most used keyboard layout, and the Coleman, which is the third. So that basically means the keys are jumbled around to what you might be used to. Now, interestingly, the QWERTY layout was designed in the 19th century to basically slow down people's typing, because they had typewriters back then, and what was happening was people were getting so fast at typing that the keys were sticking. So rather than move the keys slightly further apart to prevent this, and perhaps do some other things, they designed the QWERTY keyboard. It's actually the keyboard that you see in front of you has been designed to be inefficient for typing, to try and slow people down. That's not been the case. I mean, it slowed down people initially, but now people are pretty fast on it. Also, if you have a look at the top line on your QWERTY keyboard there, you'll notice, and this is, I don't know to what extent this is true or not, but apparently it was designed, and I think this was the 1930s or so, but to allow typewriter salesmen to easily type the word typewriter. And if you look, you can actually see how that would be the case. Bastards. So, since then,
with an optional Q.
I know, right? So nowadays, and I'm actually considering moving to Dvorak and Coleman because you can get far faster with them, but also far less repetitive stress injury risk because your fingers are having to move around a lot less. They've been more scientifically done. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. But that's the QWERTY keyboard. So now you're all familiar with it. And back to this research. So we know that how a word is spoken can affect its meaning. We know that, for example, the kind of object that someone is holding when they're speaking to someone can affect how they feel about the person to whom they're speaking. All kinds of things are actually enormously malleable in our impressions. And so what's happening is that we seem to be connecting the meanings of words with the physical way we type them on the keyboard. Now, this may be because on the right-hand side of the keyboard, and everything TGB and right is considered the right-hand side of the keyboard, those letter combinations are more difficult to type than, are easier to type than letter combinations on the left-hand side of the keyboard. And so we may be more likely to like words that can be typed on the right-hand side of the keyboard. Now, handedness could come into this. The researchers say that they do want to have a look into handedness. Of course, language is going to be an issue, all kinds of things. So, but really interesting, the researchers analyzed 1,000 word indexes from English, Spanish, and Dutch comparing their perceived positivity with the location on the QWERTY keyboard, and the effect was there. Right-sided words scored more positively than left-sided words, and of course with newer words that correlation was even stronger. They also used 800 typists through Amazon's Mechanical Turk service. Now, if anyone's not ever had a look at the Mechanical Turk service and how it works, fascinating service that, and you know, anyone or everyone can use it or be on it. And look, the literal meanings are obviously, well, probably going to outweigh any associations with them, but certainly worth bearing in mind what's going to go on over the years. Of course, they're also going to start looking at other keyboard layouts, for example, such as Dvorak or Coleman, or at least, sorry, Colmac, or at least they want to. But I imagine funding will be an issue. And the question also is, you know, to what extent or how much longer are we even going to be using keyboards? I don't know. That's me done.
That's really cool. I'm staring fixatedly at my keyboard now. I'm mystified by the psychological implications that it contains.
Indeed.
I think it also just contains a lot of dead skin cells, but you know, we won't talk too much about that.
Yeah, and I will apologize to any listeners. It really is Colmac, not Coleman. I'm not sure why I was having a brain fade there.
Well, I think, Amy, just because we're on a segue roll, I have something which might be able to help you out. we're onto our Cyblogs posts now, and this week there's a very interesting lecture, which we'll come back to later on. But one of the posts this week, one of the guest posts by Dr. Donna Rose Addis from the Centre for Brain Research in the University of Auckland, has written a post called "Truth or Lie? Can MRI Help Scientists Read Our Mind?" And spoiler alert, no. It can help us interpret what people are thinking and how people are feeling, however. So we mentioned this on TOSP last week because I'm an idiot and I got the week wrong when we were doing the events, but that's fine because no one listens anyway. So what this group of researchers is doing is they're using functional magnetic resonance imaging to actually image the brain while people are thinking, and specifically while they're lying or not lying. So functional magnetic resonance imaging is just one of these deeply cool new imaging technologies that we've been working with for the past wee while. And so magnetic resonance, it's, you know, those large, round, terrifying machines that you have in hospitals that people get shoved into the center of and they hear these whirring noises.
MRIs.
And you have to take everything. Yes, everything, you have to take your magnetic things out of your pockets or they'll go through everything. We're using these now to monitor in real time things like blood flow. So this is why it's so useful for imaging the brain in real time, because you don't have to inject any of these radioactive chemicals, you don't have to do anything horrible to the human being other than put them inside of one of these machines and watch them live, really, and think. So how they work is they watch the magnetic response of tissues. And one of the things about the tissues in our body, particularly our blood, is that it's full of hemoglobin. Hemoglobin contains iron, and it comes in two different forms. You've got your oxygenated, which is your nice bright red blood, which is helping you live, and you've got your deoxygenated, which is darker, kind of almost a mauvey, purpley coloured blood. But the other thing about that, when you get deoxygenated blood, the hemoglobin, so the iron within the hemoglobin, actually changes its magnetic structure. So it switches from being highly magnetic to being not as magnetic, just by the change in how many oxygens are around it. And this means that you can actually pick it up with these magnetic resonance images, because it changes the magnetic response of the tissues that it's in. But it changes it in an amount that's related to how quickly the oxygen is being consumed. And so this is why this technique is so good for getting detailed structures of the brain, because your brain is obviously using huge amounts of energy. I don't have the statistic right here, but I think it's about something like 30% or something of your overall energy is actually used up within your brain. So there are these big changes, and you can pick them up relatively easily with these these functional magnetic resonance imaging techniques. And I've just realized that that's a really strange name, because you wouldn't really sell a non-functional magnetic resonance imager. But anyway, continuing swiftly along, what these researchers have done is they've monitored the function of the brain and how much specifically glucose it metabolizes and how much oxygen it uses up when people are lying or when they're not lying. And they've noticed that there is a significant difference. And trust the US, a company has already sprung up called No Lie MRI Inc., claiming to provide a functional magnetic resonance imaging polygraph test, if you like. Now, this is rubbish, to put it bluntly. The brain, like everything else to do with your human body, is mind-bendingly complex. You can assess how people are thinking. You can't tell exactly what they're thinking using fMRI. But what they have done... Sorry, I've just completely lost my train of thought and track here, so I'll cut this out. Right, so one of the really cool things about these MRIs is that when you're trying to figure out if someone is lying or not, it's actually really, really easy to fake. You can just think about random things. And this will change your emotional response. It will change how much oxygen is being metabolized in your brain. And so you will scramble the MRI. So that doesn't make a great analysis tool for something like a courtroom. But it is quite interesting that you can probe into people's emotional state using external magnetic field that's completely non-invasive, which is, I think, really cool. Yeah. If you're interested in finding out more about this, there is a lecture at the Auckland Museum this Wednesday, so the 14th of March at 7 to 8:30 p.m. There is a $10 ticket fee, but they're going to explain this in detail. They'll do a much better job than me, and I think it sounds really interesting. If I wasn't stuck here in Wellington, I'd definitely go.
I'd get along to that as well, everybody, if I were you. It looks to be fascinating. Alrighty, and then I'll just chat through mine at the moment, and then I think we're pretty much done. Of course, now I've managed to lose the link to it, but give me one moment, dear peoples, and I'll be right back with you. Ah, there it is. Right, so this is a blog post from Karen O'Keefe. She's got the blog Sleep on It on Cyblogs. Unfortunately, she's very busy, so she doesn't get to post very often, but when she does, it's always fascinating, of course, her subject being sleep science. So this is about the supposed myth of the 8-hour sleep and whether that supposed myth is in fact a myth. So it's this weird sort of looping thing. Now, last week, a colleague and her gave a presentation to a group of GPs, and their introduction by a GP colleague gave a sort of a very light-hearted overview of the importance of sleep, which I think is fantastic, including this idea that 8 hours of sleep was a myth. And Karen said she felt slightly panicked at the suggestion because, you know, how did she manage to miss something that huge considering that sleep is what she does for a living? Well, no, sorry. Study sleep is what she does for a living.
I like that job.
Ah, me too. And so what she found was a BBC News article titled The Myth of the 8-Hour Sleep, which frankly I expect better of the BBC in terms of their headlines. If anybody wants to go and just be really angry, go and read, and we'll link to Karen's blog post, go and read the Daily Mail article that was clearly based just off the BBC article but hadn't looked at any of the original information and gets it just, wow, mind-numbingly wrong. But anyway, back to the subject at hand, which was the myth of the 8-hour sleep. Now, What they were saying, or what the article didn't actually manage to put across very well, was it's not that we need fewer than 8 hours of sleep a day. It's that we don't necessarily need 8 hours of sleep all at once. And this is called biphasic sleep. So the idea of sleeping in two sort of four-ish hour chunks across the evening, or when you get around to sleeping. It's not a new one. I mean, there are lots of historical reports of people waking up for a couple of hours in the middle of the night. You know, they'd read, they'd write, they'd go and visit neighbors, they'd, you know, shag each other, they'd do all kinds of things, really, to while away the time. Because, of course, you know, don't forget that they had no electric lights, there were no TVs, there were no tablets, there was no radio, nothing like that. So if people were going to bed with sunset and waking up at sunrise, that was actually potentially quite a lot more than 8 hours of darkness. And it does make a lot of sense. So in fact, in the early 1990s, Thomas Vere investigated the effect of changing the length of daytime light exposure and so, of course, night length on sleep, and found that with long nights, human sleep did indeed occur in bouts with periods of what he called quiet wakefulness during the night. When he gave people a 14-hour sleep opportunity, which sounds glorious, they had a few days of catch-hour sleep, so 11 hours in total, and then followed by, again, this biphasic sleep in two main bouts with sort of each bout of sleep lasting 2 to 5 hours with a wakefulness period lasting 1 to 3 hours. And you know what that comes out to? 8.25 hours of sleep per day on average.
Cool.
So everybody remember that. It looks like, and of course it varies hugely between people. Some people do need more sleep, less sleep, depends on your mood, your age, everything like that. But about 8 hours, you shouldn't be getting a lot less than that generally. But if you need to break it up, you know, that's okay as well.
Cool. Well, I'm gonna take that on board and try and actually be productive in the middle of the night, I think.
I'm going to sleep too late for that. I mean, I basically, yeah, I don't work it that way. But yes.
Right. Well,
I'm done.
Okay. Well, that's pretty much us for the week, I think. I'm just looking at the events, and other than that mind reading lecture, I've actually got nothing else on my calendar for this week.
There's actually.
Amy, do you have anything to add?
I'm just having a look. No, not really. The Synthetic Biology Future Symposium is happening in Australia on Tuesday, March the 13th. So I imagine we'll be talking about that next week, because that is a big deal. And there have been New Zealand biologists involved in organizing it and speaking at it and so forth. So, but otherwise, no, it's a quiet week.
All right, fantastic. Well, I guess we'll finish up, as per usual, by thanking everyone who makes the podcast possible. To State Shirt and Rian Sheehan for our opening and closing themes, respectively, and, of course, to Cyblogs and the lovely Cybloggers for providing us with stories and general inspiration. Remember, you can subscribe to TOSP via iTunes, you can follow or listen at YouTube, or you can follow our RSS feed at cyblogs.co.nz/TOSP, or you can catch us on the cool Zilln Cool Science channel, or at Science Podcasters. If you've got any comments or suggestions, just get in touch via the blog. And if you like us, try and write a review on iTunes, if you would be so kind, because it does help us get up on the front page, or just to share a link to this week or any week's episode via social networking stuff before the sun explodes and knocks it all down. Remember, you can follow Cyblogs posts by subscribing to emails, Twitter, RSS, or by visiting the Cyblogs homepage at cyblogs.co.nz. Other than that, you can